pleasure to be here. Apologies for being a little bit late. Where meetings are already flowing into each other. It's a pleasure to be here. The board has been making a habit, quite deliberately, of trying to meet with each group and do so in a setting where we can get into substantive matters. The social kind of interactions are fun and useful in their own way, but we found these meetings to be quite helpful in just plunging directly into matters of substance. So as you, I think, are fully aware, we've asked you to prepare some questions for us, and we've prepared some questions for you. And with that, yeah.
If I could do a little housekeeping, please. Can you identify yourself when you speak for the record so the scribes will be able to accurately reflect who's speaking? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane. So who are you speaking on? So, John, say a word or two, and then let's plunge right in.
So the happy to be here speaking to the board. I think it's wonderful to meet with you folks at each ICANN meeting. I have with me, the CEO of APNIC, our executive director, Paul Wilson. I have, Raul is down there somewhere. Raul, yes, thank you. We have Adil, is Adil here? Coming. And we don't have Axel. Axel's taking a well-earned vacation. Is Paul Rendek here? No, Bess? Ah, okay, thank you. So not Paul. So we're happy to be here. And we have Louis Lee, who is the chair of the ASO Advisory Council. Address Council, thank you. I did that. Yes, okay. Address Council. There were two items we were going to provide an update on. These just things that have come up. One of them is IPv4 transfers and markets, and I was going to speak to that. And then also the status of IPv6 deployment. Those have been the two things that have come up most frequently. I guess the only other thing I see down there looking at this is the ASO review report update. We gave that in the opening, and we thought it was very successful. We gave a presentation in the Monday that highlighted the activities that were coming this week, how to participate in upcoming RIR meetings, what policy proposals were active, and we had people come up to the microphone and say that was a great 15-minute summary of how to get engaged in number policy. So we think that went very well, and since we don't have Friday now, we can do that at the beginning of the week, do it very briefly, and provide a way for the folks who are here at ICANN attending the meeting to not only know what's happening outside of ICANN, but what we're doing in the upcoming week. We'd be interested in feedback on that format, whether or not people thought it went well. I don't know whether the board was able to all attend it. We could go through it here because we have the time if you wish to do it. So, questions?
Sebastian?
Yeah, as I say publicly during your forum, you were the first ASO and SE who tried to replace what was organized on Friday, and you set up the scene for the other. I am sure that they will ask for something similar. It was good, it was interesting, it was short, and even it was very good that the next meeting was so much important for one part of the community that they were obliged to see what you are doing because you are part of our community. And if we can do that next time also to have some obligation for the GTLD people to come to listen about IP and all the work you do, we will do a great job in this community to learn better about what you are doing and we are in charge of, not just one little piece of the cake. Thank you.
Very well said. I was going to try to give some positive feedback, but I can't begin to match Sebastian's.
Very good. RPKI update, I guess I'll do this in two pieces. One is that tomorrow, tomorrow's today. Today, later on today, the esteemed Jeff Houston, who is hiding in the back of the room, will be providing an RPKI update to the GAC, and of course that's an open session, and everyone is welcome to attend. That will be a pretty high level talking about some of the conceptual issues that are associated with RPKI. In terms of more working implementation, we continue to work together and work with ICANN on RPKI. Again, we don't have a uniform green light, meaning all the RIR communities have not said proceed full speed ahead. The IAB did send an issue saying we would like to have RPKI and we'd like to have a single trust anchor. The RIRs have echoed that. We believe that RPKI is a useful service, and we believe that it's something that we're suited to offer. We'd like to see a single trust anchor, or that has been we'd like to explore the options available with that, and we've been doing so with the team under release in ICANN. There's a lot of interesting details with RPKI, and Jeff will go through it at a high level, but recognize that it is not just a list of numbers, it's a hierarchy or a tree, and when things like transfers occur, there's a lot of decisions about how those occur in this technology. So we're continuing work. We actually had a productive meeting earlier this week, presuming that the community signs off and says we want this, we will move from having individual RPKI offerings, which is what we all have now, to having a single global RPKI. And of course, if you want the high-level issues involved, the presentation with the GAC later today would be great. Any questions on what I presented on RPKI update?
Just a comment, please, for the scribes. If you could, when you begin talking, please say your name. Thank you.
This is John Curran, and I'll continue now. ASO Prague activities, we have a number of them. Of course, this meeting with you, the meeting with the GAC later on today on RPKI, we had the... we had, of course, our call to action, our review report update at the beginning, which was well received. We will also have an IPv6 session tomorrow talking about IPv6 deployment, and that should be a very good session. So we have a pretty full calendar of activities here. And we have we've also been meeting with individual organizations, of course, such as the ALAC, trying to expand the involvement of the at-large constituency in the RIR community. I guess I'll move on and talk about IPv4 transfers and markets if there's not any questions. Okay. IPv4 transfers and markets. We actually have transfer policies in several of the regions, Aran region, AP NIC region, and it's in discussion in other regions at this point. We have active transfers going on of address space. So parties who have IPv4 address space and no longer need it or can renumber out of it because it's much more than they want or they used it in a sparse manner, can find a party that has need and transfer the address space. This has occurred, if you go to the Aran webpage, for example, we've had more than 50 blocks transfer from one party to the other. We find this actually facilitates higher utilization and conservation of address space, so it makes sense. The community in the regions have set controls on what's a valid transfer. In the Aran region, for example, it's a 24-month demand is what you can transfer, which means parties who might have neglected their V6 planning can go get a small amount of address space to give them some breathing room so they can get with the program, but they can't know that they're going to have 10 years worth of address space at their command. We all have transfer policies within our region. Aran, AP NIC, LACNIC is discussing transfer role. Transfer policy, none in the LACNIC region right now.
We have a transfer policy, but it will be activated only when we reach the last part of our stock, the last reserve.
Thank you, Raul. That's right, I remember. Not active right now, but they have a transfer policy. This has led to parties that are helping people get rid of their address space or find address space, brokers per se. A lot of the brokers are following the community policies. We have not a lot of difficulty with them. We do have some friction out there. People will hear about it. The Aran region, we don't process a transfer that doesn't meet community policy. This has led to some angst, since some people want to transfer address space as if it was property. And you'll hear the friction. You'll see the email. But it's actually going very well. We've actually had also bankruptcy courts now have picked up on realizing that these can be monetized. If an estate is closing, one of the things that's useful is to make sure the address space moves to someone who needs it. And we've had now 7 or 8 transfers occur with result of bankruptcy courts, all of which have explicit language recognizing the regional registry and agreeing to the policies developed by the community. So this is emerging, very interesting environment. It's not designed to be a way of keeping V4 running forever, but it does allow for better utilization of the space and provides us a short reprieve for those who need it. Questions on IPv4 transfers?
I have a question. There's presumably some sort of market, maybe not too stable or firm, but a price per address as the metric of it. Are you seeing that number go up, down, fluctuate? And what is your estimate for when that market will begin to die off?
So I'll answer for the Aran region. We actually don't make a market. We don't ask about the transfer price. All we do is confirm that the recipient is qualified and that the holder is actually the legitimate registrant. So the transfer occurs and the contract for sale, we don't see the sale price. We don't know what that might be. There's word on the street that the numbers are $10 or $11 an IP address and that that's materially unchanged. So the short answer is that we don't have good visibility into it. The community in the Aran region did not ask for that level of surveillance, but it seems fairly stable at this time at around 10 or 11. And that, because we're still issuing address space in parallel, we don't expect to see that change until we hit run out, which for us is early next year, first quarter, second quarter 2013. I guess, Paul, do you have visibility into the APNIC transfers?
No, not in terms of price, but again, the rumor on the street is sort of $10 to sometimes you hear $40 as an upper bound, maybe, in my experience. I really don't think that that there are enough transfers happening yet, and there won't be until the interregional transfers open up to really see where it's going to.
The higher prices for ones that are in mint condition and have no fingerprints on them and so forth.
Absolutely, yeah. They all are. They all are.
There is actually a little bit of truth to what you say. There are IP addresses that have been hijacked by parties in the past or have been used by bulk unsolicited commercial email senders, which may be in filter lists and therefore may not be as useful as others. But in general, we don't have enough trend right now to really see where it's going.
Go ahead, Ray.
Paul mentioned interregional transfers, and I was going to ask you, could you give us some update on what the status of that is as far as a globally coordinated policy?
Sure. In the Aran region and in the APNIC region, both have adopted a globally coordinated policy. It's not a global policy. It doesn't affect resources to or from the IANA. But it's a globally coordinated policy in that we pass policy text that's compatible with one another. And in both cases, it says a transfer from one region to the other can occur. The receiver with the seller, the region with the seller makes sure the seller is legitimate and the appropriate address holder. The recipient's region verifies that the recipient has the appropriate need. Those policies were adopted in both regions, and we expect to be in the implementation phase probably within the next 2 weeks in the Aran region. We'll be done. I'm told the same for the APNIC. So we may begin to see our first inter-RIR transfers. That shouldn't be surprising since APNIC has been in its austerity measures for some time now, and Aaron is the region that has a great deal of address space that was issued pre-CIDR in very large, very large awkward sizes, and therefore more likely to be transferred.
Ray Polzak, follow-on question. Do you see any clash, or I don't know if that's exactly the correct word, between the interregional transfer policy and the recently passed global policy regarding handing address space back to the IANA?
This is John. I'll answer that. We don't see any clash whatsoever. Again, we have a situation where, in some cases, we're still issuing address space while people are doing these transfers. It's really to provide the transfer mechanisms provide a market-friendly way to improve utilization of IP address space already issued. The fact that we are issuing space and the fact that we're actually taking space that's been returned to us and returning it to the IANA for reallocation is all the unallocated pool. The allocated pool, it's very difficult to encourage good utilization of the allocated IPv4 pool unless you do it by two mechanisms. One would be forced reclamation of unused numbers, and the other one would be a market mechanism. Forced reclamation is not business or service provider friendly, and is guaranteed to create contention. By creating a limited market mechanism, the address space pool that's already been issued will hopefully make it to people who need it. So,
Thomas? Okay. Elise?
Hi. If you're moving to the next topic, I just wanted to say one more thing about IPv4, and it goes back to Ray's question. He asked about the current global policy that was just recently sent to the board from the ASO on post-IPv4 exhaustion. And I just wanted to bring the board up to date to let you know that we're in discussions with the RIRs. We had a meeting here this week to talk about the allocation recovery pool and how it'll be structured and then how it'll be allocated once the trigger is set. So those discussions are ongoing from the operational implementation perspective. The policy's been passed by everybody in this room, and now we're working on the implementation.
Good. And I see Adil is sitting here. Hi. Next.
Okay. This is John Curran.
Before you get into this area, I've got two questions that I would like you to consider as you're making your presentation. It probably would fold into what you're going to say anyway. I don't know if you were in the room yesterday in the NCSG session, but there was a mention about the FBI and had some designs on IPv6. So I'd like you to, in the course of this, discuss that. And the other item is that, you know, as you're aware, the GTLD program requires people that are going to be successful operators of new GTLDs to be IPv6 capable. And so I would like, if you could, to talk about a little bit how that could influence the actual adoption and deployment of IPv6.
Thank you, Ray. This is John Curran. I'll now move on to IPv6 adoption and address those points. I guess the first thing everyone probably is aware of is that on 6/6/2012, June 6th, we had World IPv6 Launch Day. And that was where major content providers around the globe, including Google, Facebook, YouTube, Bing, all turned on IPv6 in parallel with V4 permanently, turned it on and left it on. If you connect to those websites, you will find out that you're using IPv6 if you're on an IPv6-capable network. That includes more than half of the top 10 sites in terms of popularity. It includes 200 popular sites out of the top 1,000. So we're beginning to get traction with the content providers. Service providers also participated in World IPv6 Launch Day. This was involving a lot of service providers who committed to trying to get 1% of their customer base, existing base, in enabled with IPv6. So we actually do consider it a success. It was coordinated by the Internet Society and the founding service providers who launched the initiative. It's very important that we get all the content on IPv6 because at the point in time when you go to use IPv6 to connect up a new customer, if 100% of the content is V6 reachable, you're pretty much done. And if only 10% of the content or 20% of the content is reachable, you have to find a way to still get them an IPv4 address, even if temporarily. So it's essential to get everyone's website dual-homed on V4 and V6. World IPv6 launch day was a big step in that direction, and we encourage people to continue to push for IPv6 deployment. Service providers at some point will not be able to continue to grow unless we've gotten the content on IPv6. With respect to the questions about IPv6 deployment, first, we're encouraged by the new GTLD program and the requirements for IPv6 support. That's very much a very good thing. I do think we probably need to do some cross-coordination, sort of in the nature of ICANN, just to make sure that the support for IPv6 is support for both the records in DNS that are used by V6 and the network protocols that you can do queries over. That's something that we need to do fairly quickly to make sure that we agree on what this V6 profile is for new GTLDs. But, yes.
Thomas Norton here. Are you talking about like what's in the contracts for the operators? Yeah, you can look at that, but I think we've done a pretty good job. It's transport and everything.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. There's a reference to an appendix, and I just didn't have a chance to pull it. It would be good to sort of, in the nature of the inter-SO formal coordination, formally send that to the ASO so they can look at it, because that's kind of what happens with cross-SO coordination.
You're making a note on that, Thomas?
Yeah. Yeah,
thank you.
And then the last item is the last item to address what Ray raised is recently I think some people have seen some press headlines. I was certainly surprised, even though I was quoted in some of the articles. One of them said FBI says don't deploy IPv6. Anybody who's chatted with the FBI understands that's not accurate. The U.S. government actually has a stated policy goal to have IPv6 deployed on its public websites by the end of 2012. That includes all the agencies, including Department of Justice and FBI. But the article did bring out something that's very real, and it's a side effect of the transition to IPv6 that maybe wasn't clearly foreseen. Presently, law enforcement uses the IP whois, the whois directory of who holds what IP blocks, as a pointer when it's doing its research and investigations. We actually have policies in all the regions. We have policies that consider, for example, privacy issues with residential privacy, where we redact information from the public whois. But the fact is, when law enforcement has an IP address in a mail message or an IP address from a given DDoS attack or command and control network, they look it up in whois to try to figure out where to start their investigation, where are they going to serve a subpoena or a lawful warrant. The reason that the whois for IP addresses is accurate is because when service providers need their next IPv4 block, they have to show utilization of their prior IPv4 block, which means all of their delegations to organizations need to be reflected in the whois. That's how they show their regional registry that they've achieved whatever the utilization level is, 80% or whatever the threshold is in that region. So historically, we've had very good IPv4 whois information because the act of getting your next block ensures the prior block gets accurately documented in whois. Well, when we go to V6, I think you guys probably are aware, V6 blocks are big. The smallest IPv6 block is maybe enough for a service provider for many, many years. It could be decades. And so if an ISP gets an address block And the primary reason why they've been updating the public who is to show it's utilized to get the next address block. But with V6, they don't ever come back for that next address block. It's possible that in the day-to-day business of doing all the other things running their ISP, they may not update who is. And therefore, all you'll have is a directory to the ISP, not to his 10,000 customers, because he hasn't been putting the individual delegations in. This is a challenge. The RIRs can encourage customers, service providers, to update who is, but we don't have a lot of tools to enforce that. And so one of the things that was noted by the Aaron Government Working Group, which has representatives of law enforcement from our region, including RCMP, FBI, Interpol, CICS, et cetera, is they're so dependent on a WHOIS directory, which may not have any good mechanisms to ensure it's going to be current 10 years from now when we deploy IPv6. It doesn't say don't deploy V6. It was a question more to our institutions of self-governance. How do we ensure that these records are updated so that law enforcement can continue to do the job it's doing? I think that's still an open question. It's going to be discussed in all the regions, but it's not a reason not to deploy V6. It's a reason to worry about accurate record keeping by ISPs. I'll take questions on that.
Ray, did you want to follow up at all with the... I'm sorry.
Did I know I didn't? Thank you, John.
Thank you, Rob, and then was it Bruce? Or did,
oh. This is Rob Bloxall, chairman of RIPE. I want to add a little bit to what John said. And in the RIPE region, we have the same principles of the WHOIS, only we do not insist that the ISPs publish their sub-allocations in the public WHOIS. They are invited to do so, but some ISPs say, no, I'm not going to publish a list of my customers. So for commercial reasons, they might not be willing to do that. However, in their contract with the RIPE NCC, they have the obligation to keep a registry of what they did with their address blocks. They may keep it internally, but they must open it on request to the RIPE NCC to do an audit. And that usually takes place when they come back for the next address block request. So though it is not publicly available, it is there. And we have never heard any serious complaints from law enforcement agencies that they find this an unworkable situation. They're happy enough that the next level of the registry is kept up to date. So if they have an individual IP address that they want to investigate, they can, from the public database, find out easily to whom it was delegated by the RIPE NCC, and then they go to that ISP for their further investigation. So I think it is not as black and white as some people think. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce, and then Adil.
Yeah, I was just interested, because WHOIS is obviously a very active debate within the GNSO at the moment. So if I understand correctly, you
Yeah, because in many countries there is no formal law in data protection and where a local government can use to get access to the right information with the ISP. So they tend to rely on AFRINIC to provide them the accurate information. And we have the same kind of the same RSA, Registration Service Agreement, with our member, where they have the obligation, in fact, to store or register all the allocation and assignment and sub-allocation in our WHOIS database. But as Rob said, not all of them are willing to disclose all the information about that. And one of the things we are saying to governments is that, you know, you need to participate to our policy development process and know what our policies are, because we have an IPv4 policy that says you have to register your information, and the contract that ISP in your country have with us, ask them to do so. If you know that policy, you can talk with your ISP with more knowledge. But if you don't know that we have it, you cannot discuss with it. That's one reason, more reason for you to look at what we are doing, because you can use it locally. So it's an education process where I think even law enforcement people must, you know, understand really what the policy are to be able to enforce them locally, because that goes back to local law and local relationship between them and the ISP at the end.
Thank you. John, you wanted to talk, and then
Judith. Briefly, I just want to say we also have requirements in our agreements for people to maintain this information. And with regards to the question asked about jurisdiction and who gets access to the information, we also point law enforcement. We say this block went to this ISP, and so you can definitely go to that ISP. The challenge is that there's a requirement for ISPs to, in our region, to include the delegations to individual business customers. And so when those aren't present, it's not that law enforcement doesn't have an option. It can go to the ISP. But note that can be go to an ISP, serve a warrant for information, find their customer as an ISP, repeat the process to serve a warrant. If what is being sought is something active, such as a kidnapping, that's a long process. ISPs don't necessarily take service on the weekend or 24 hours, particularly smaller ones. So there's a question of timeliness if this information requires you to serve each ISP in turn, and that's really what's being raised by those FBI headlines you saw.
Judith?
To provide a little Philippine color, the Philippine National Police was often hacked, had to hide behind my network, and so which is why they don't require updated who is.
Good. Where does that put us on your list, John?
We're done. That's the full set of items we wanted to provide an update. We're happy to take any other questions from the board.
So, as you say, that's an update. The title for that slide says questions. Is there anything that you want to ask of us or that you need for us to respond?
I do not believe we came up with a list of questions. We got together the
other
day.
That's fine. That's fine.
So we're happy to make some up if you want, but we're here. Yeah. We're pleased to serve you. If there's anything we can help you with, let us know.
Super. Let me note that Fadi Shahadi has joined us, and thank you. The other half of this kind of exchange are questions and material from us. We have a couple of slides. I think that we'll put them both up, but I think that we'll not focus on one aspect of this. But let's, if you're ready, let me suggest we move on. So let's have the next slide. So these are questions that we've been asking across all of the groups. What do you think or have to say related to the RAA negotiation, the Register Accreditation Agreement negotiations? What are your feelings or thoughts about the WHOIS report in particular? What aspects do you think should be policy work versus left to staff? You may not want to respond to that. And then in the budget and operations plan cycle, are the comment periods of adequate length? Are there any other comments you would have on that? And then just for completeness, we'll put up the other slide, but I suspect it won't be necessary to delve into it here. These are all related to the new GTLD program and the batching, which I'm sure you've heard about. And it's an opportunity to avoid a problem if you want to not jump into it, but the questions there are, do you have any views on whether there should or shouldn't be a single batch? If you think a single batch is the right thing, what kind of acceptable time frame would you have? And if there is to be batching, do you believe that there's a consensus that a method other than digital archery should be used? That is, is there a consensus on walking away from digital archery, not a consensus on where you would be walking toward? Ray?
Thank you, Steve. Could you go back a slide? What I actually would be interested in hearing on the RAA negotiations is that the RAA equivalent in the regional registry world is the Registration Services Agreement. And so I'm wondering if there's any lessons learned because the registries literally have got thousands of contracts that they have with various service providers that you might want to pass along to the people that are fumbling through the RAA negotiation.
John?
We have not discussed these questions as a group. Therefore, there's no feedback from the RIRs on these as a group. I actually think that most of these are quite interesting and should keep the board busy for some time. Full of thought about the fact that you guys seem to be well involved in DNS policy, and I wish that you had a DNS organization that gave you consensus approaches like we do, but that's okay. I will answer Ray's question because it's worth answering. The regional internet registries are all member-based organizations, and therefore we have each of us here runs an organization as the executive of that organization. We have boards that are elected, and because we're very focused as regional membership organizations, it is true we have to update our registration agreements with our community, but the community has, through election processes and payment of fees and member meetings, has ample local feedback mechanisms to make sure we get them right. And so, to some extent, because the service relationship is very much regional to its members and very focused, this negotiation I don't think has been a problem in any of the regions, but I would welcome comments from my fellow executives.
Paul?
Paul Wilson from APNIC. Ray's question is an interesting one, and I'd just like to make a comment in case it's not clear why. And it comes back to an issue that's raised quite often within the addressing world, which is does the addressing system not have a two-tier structure like a registrar model that you see in domain names, particularly where it introduces competition at the registrar level? In fact, we do, and it is the registry ISP model where the competition is actually embodied within the competing ISPs who compete in the use of the IP addresses that are allocated to them. So it is the agreement between the registry, that is the RIR, and the ISP, which Ray referred to as a registration services agreement, which is parallel here. And I think, as John said, that agreement is something that's a regional matter for each of the RIRs to develop in consultation with their memberships. And in the case of APNIC, for instance, that agreement has been updated from time to time in a bottom up consultative sort of fashion through our normal governance processes. But that parallel with the domain name registration system was the one that I wanted to point out in particular, because it's quite an interesting and important feature, relatively speaking, between the two systems. Thanks.
Very good. Quill?
Yeah, I think, as I was in the APNIC for EC for 11 years, I think those are issues. I think basically the IR, they don't have a similar issue at all. But I think there is some kind of purpose for this meeting too. Is what is the position of the IR or NRO looking for the ITU issue, also the WCIT, and how we can work together or what kind of strategy you're going to do, and how we can participate? I think that is a very important, not only for you, also for the whole community. I think. We'd like to know is any experience or any strategy you discuss about it, and how you're going to do it and how we can fit in and, you know, not go along, something like that.
Yeah, thanks, Quo. That's a good question. The RIRs, being regional organisations, we do operate quite specifically independently within our regions, and corresponding to our regions within the UN system, or within the ITU system, are a bunch of regional, roughly corresponding regional structures. So I think it goes for all of the RIRs that we are most active at the regional level with those regional preparatory processes, the regional organisations that we roughly correspond to. So, for instance, in the APNIC region, it's the APT, the Asia-Pacific Telecommunity, which is channeling the national positions into the ITU. And we've been pretty active. We've been involved with preparatory meetings. We've been involved with the APT for quite some time, well before WICCET, of course. But in particular with WICCET, there have been preparatory meetings. There are more preparatory meetings coming up, and we're using that as the primary sort of channel to reach the parts of governments that are involved with that process, who we often don't actually reach, frankly, through the more what we'd call traditional internet channels into ministries of IT and so forth. So that's where we're active, and I think most of the RIRs are planning to converge on the Dubai meeting, but mostly as a continuation of the regional connections and the regional processes and discussions that have been going on. But I'm sure the others can also comment on what's been happening in their regions respectively. Thanks.
Good. Rob, did you want to, Rob Loxall, did you want to say?
Just for the board members who are not that much aware of the details, when we talk about regional organizations, just let me give you one number to indicate the size these organizations can be. And I'm now speaking on behalf of RIPE, where we have close to 9,000 members, ISPs, and we are covering roughly 70, 75 countries. The whole of geographical Europe, the Middle East, Central Asia, and the whole of the former Soviet Union. So it's regional, but some of the regions can be large. And yeah, the service agreement we reach, we are a membership-driven organization. So basically it's the members that in most cases initiate changes to existing agreements. The task of the executive, the office, is they have their own interests. They don't want to see 9,000 different contracts. So various requests from members come, and it is the challenge for the board of the organization to find a workable compromise. But in our region, with our very diverse, different cultures, it seems to work quite well.
Good. Anything else, Quill?
Another two possible issue you might be touching about that is, I know all the RR, you already have many experience talking to the government regarding for the IP address issues, and as the same, we have a gag here, and several of them actually is the same office, right? You know, in the gag representative also, you are facing into, you know, in each region. I think the office is about similar. And maybe in the future we can think about how we can work together to serve those of the government officers better. You know, this is one of the possible we can discuss. I mean, maybe we can work together, you know, to serve as a government office better, because you serve the same office we serve the GAC. Another one is, let me finish the second one, then Raul, you can comment about it. The next one is, I think I know, at least in the APNIC, you have, you know, helping the developing countries, you know, something like that. You have fund for helping the developing countries. And actually, the ICANN, we are setting the fund for the developing country too, you know. So is any way we can work together to help in the developing country, and that, I think there's much as solid we can come out.
Raul, you wanted to respond, and then Ray wants to chime in.
Yes, just a comment. We already work very much with ICANN in coordinating the efforts regarding relations with governments. I think that most of the work is done at the regional level, but since ICANN has decentralized their operations or some part of the operations, it is much easier for us to work in the field with ICANN officers. In fact, in Latin America, we have a very good work, and we have a very high level of coordination among internet organizations, ICANN, internet society, and it is working very well. And beside that, we have coordination on another level, that is the through the ISTARS meeting, when the leaders of the internet organizations meet frequently, and so we already had one meeting this year, and we expect to have another one in September, beginning of September. And so all the governmental relationships and everything related with WCAG and WTSA has been one of the hottest topic in those meetings. So, of course, we can do more, but in fact, I think that it is. For this kind of work, at least for us in Latin America, due to the small number of governments from our region that participate in the GAC meetings, it is much more useful to work with ICANN and other organizations, but in other environments like regional organizations, regional intergovernmental organizations, is much more effective for us. But thank you.
Ray, Paul, and Adil.
Thank you, Steve. Ray Balzac, for the record. Slightly different approach here, question. As a way of background, I was the co-chair with Heather Dryden on the Board GAC working group that actually conducted a review of certain things. And one of the items that came out of there was the provision of GAC advice early in the policy development process. And as a result of that, we issued a report, and now the working group that's implementing that report recommendations has taken that on, and I'm also a member of that working group. But the thing that we're working on, and I'd actually like to get some input from the regional registries, but not necessarily here today, is that first of all, you all recognize that GAC can't give you advice that early on in the formative stages of a policy. It just won't work. However, it's been my experience when I was at Aaron, and it is experience I've observed in the regions that there is a way of, that you do get what amounts to government insight into effects or that policies may have and so forth. And so as this working group is going forward, we need to prepare some documentation, if you will, with regards to ways that this insight mechanism could work. And so what I'm just asking you is if you could, in your copious spare time, send me some notes on how you do it or on how you think it could work and things of that nature. So that's all I have, just a comment. And like I said, you don't need to respond here. Thanks.
Before we move on, while I remember, thank you for returning, Ray, to the board. The continuity and experience and his massive contributions are very much appreciated, and it certainly would not have been appropriate to comment before while you're making the decisions, and I don't know who else was selected, but just from the perspective of having a cohesive working board, this is a material help. Thank you. Paul?
Thanks, Steve. Just a quick follow-up to the summary I gave before on the regional activities. We do... As Raul said, actually coordinate on numerous levels. So we're working at the staff level with contacts within ICANN staff, also within Internet Society and others. And so some of the concrete activities have got to do with, well, exactly how we are attending and participating in some of the meetings that are going on at the moment, information sharing along those lines. Another one is publication of documents, and it's been there's been a sort of a dire need, frankly, for documentation that explains at the appropriate level some of the issues that are coming up in, for instance, in the ITR discussions. The parallels between traditional telecoms and internet matters when it comes to sort of specific provisions which might go into the ITRs, like number misuse or hubbing or international settlements and that sort of stuff. And we've been pretty active in doing that. The reason I think why I focused on the regional level, though, is because while that coordination is really important at the global level, it's very important to diversify messages. A single coordinated message will always look like it's come from a single point, and in the wicket of course, I mean, what we're looking at is the influence of individual governments, and I think I'm a strong believer that what we need to do is through the regions to disseminate our messages and our outreach directly more at the grassroots is a funny way of referring to governments, but at that disseminated level, so that we're actually reaching and having individual contact with individual governments who represent votes in the system. So I think possibly a lack of a single point of global coordination is actually a feature and not a bug, because that single point can look like it's coming from a particular place, whether it's ICANN or the Internet Society or others, and it certainly loses value if it's seen to represent one individual vote when there's another couple of hundred to worry about. Thanks.
Adil?
In fact, that's what I want to say is almost what Paul just mentioned. I think there are many several mechanisms in place for cooperation and coordination at the global level. Our iRetreat is one of them, and working with ICANN liaison in different regions is another one. But when it comes to some relationship or some discussion at government level with I believe that having regional organizations like RAR who have developed along the time some close relationship with government, with the stakeholder locally, gives some advantage to give a message that is more close to people. And I think it's an advantage for ICANN as well to leverage on that relationship or on that regionalization of the RAR to be able to address specific issue, because the issue are not always global and cannot be addressed with the same messaging across the border. So I think the collaboration between us and ICANN also has to be seen in that way, as using us as regional organization to be able to be more close to people's reality. On the government level and at the GAC level, I want also to mention that I think all of the area have now some kind of government working group. I think at AFRINIC we have a government working group which is made of representatives from government who meet at each of our meeting, and they meet to discuss policy related to IP address. And sometimes we discuss internet governance in general, because they need to discuss that. And I think that is something as well in which we can collaborate with ICANN and with the GAC specifically, because mostly is the same people who attend the GAC meeting, who attend the government working group, and having the relay between the two could be something interesting. I mean, at least at AFRINIC, we are taking this very seriously, and we are even moving even further to create a kind of formalizing the membership of this kind of institutional and non-ISP member within the structure. So it's an area that can be explored as well.
Good. We're within a minute or two of needing to wrap up here. Is there anything else that we want to say on any of these questions from the ICANN board? And I'm perfectly comfortable if the answer is no. Good. Let me ask if, so Adil, you want to say something? Go ahead.
I,
on the last point, I don't know if the question fell in that, but on the strategic planning document of ICANN, I've noticed something which I would like to probably get clarification from. I've noticed that IP address in the core activities that was defined in the strategic plan fell under DNS stability and security. That's where IP addresses are defined. And when I look at the IANA section, there is very little about IP address. So I just want to understand how that, why is IP address is related to DNS and DNS security and stability, and what is ICANN view on IP address generally when it comes to the IANA?
I don't understand. What's the difference between an IP address and a DNS? I'm joking. Yeah. Point taken and noted. We're very conscious of the quite disparate amount of attention that is devoted to DNS versus address. I think that reflects the fact that the addresses are, on the whole, less problematic. Not even though there are problems. So at the beginning, John, when you talked about having a being able to talk about what's happening and to do it in a compact fashion, I think that was very, very good, and Sebastian said it very eloquently. And I think that we have – it's not the biggest of our problems, but we have a little problem that marbles through the organization to make sure that we treat the address community with the same – respect and attention that we treat the domain name system, and that internally we need an awareness so that we don't fall into the trap that you just said. So apologies, and we'll fix that up. Good. Rod and Fadi, do you want to say any closing comments? And start with you, Rod.
Great. First, I just want to thank you for re-electing Ray to the board. I want to say Ray has been one of the most valuable board members to me as a CEO with his tremendous experience as a C-level exec, having been both a CEO and also a colonel in running very large operations. His operational management and strategy skills, in addition to all the expertise, have been invaluable. And I can remember one event in particular when we had the Nairobi situation of a very serious security incident that happened right before we were going to do our meeting, and ICANN was considering canceling the meeting, as it had in Kenya once before. Ray was the board member who helped me to distill all the complex information into a clear presentation to the board so they could make a decision. I don't know if he remembers that. It was extremely helpful to me, and it led to an efficient board meeting where I think we made the right decision to move forward. That was just one example of dozens that I can remember where Ray has helped me enormously. I also want to thank Elise, who's really, in my view, advanced the relationship with your community of the RARs and the numbering organizations, and thank her for her great efforts and the staff. And say that I've enjoyed the collaboration. And since I came here 3 years ago, it's been, John's smiling at me. We were off to a rough start with our first meeting in Sharm el Sheikh, but we made a lot of progress from there, I think. And what really shifted, a couple of things. One is the movement by your group to begin actively meeting at ICANN meetings. I mean, it gave us a chance to meet face-to-face 3 times a year. Extremely valuable to me, and I know the ICANN team. Then we added the ISTAR collaboration, giving us 2 more opportunities to meet, and I really want to thank the RARs for supporting that. It's kind of a joint effort of ICANN and the RARs to start that, and then ISOC joined, and we invited IETF and IAB, but that's now become a coordination institution, or unofficial or ad hoc group in our community. So that gave us 2 more opportunities, and with IGF, so now there's 6 opportunities a year for your leadership and ICANN leadership to meet, and I think it's just been extremely valuable. I thank you for that. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, John. Thank you, Adil. And also special thanks to Raul, who so kindly made some remarks at my going away party on Monday. It's really been great working with all of you. Appreciate it, the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Rod. Funny?
It's too early for me to add any substantive comments at the moment. But I just wanted to say that since I arrived, all I've heard is that this is the part of ICANN that works marvelously.
And we know what the hidden part of that is about everybody else, right?
Yeah. So that's encouraging. I also believe that this is a room full of CEOs, which I'll have the privilege to spend a little private time with next after this meeting. And I know what that means, and I know what gravitas this brings to how things work. I respect that. I do think also that we could learn a few lessons from you all on how you reach consensus so well.
JJ
with free coffee. Yeah. I think lessons are good, and we should share them. There's good learning that should be passed. But anyway, I look forward to work with all of you, to learn from all of you. We have a lot of work ahead. So thank you.
Thank you, everybody.